Dean, 1 o'clock. I will call this meeting of Labor and Industry, Finance and Policy to order.
I got it right this time.
Today is March 7th. I'm looking at two different pieces of paper. Anyway, Representative Mecklen, do you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have, and I move the minutes.
Motion's been made to move approval of the minutes for March 2nd, 2023. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The minutes are approved. We have a few bills on the agenda today, so hopefully we can get going on this. And first one up is return of Representative Hicks. Welcome back to the committee. House File 981, and I will move House File 981 to go to General Register. And you have an amendment, I see.
I do. Thank you, Chair and members. I'm not sure if you recall, but I was before you before regarding adult changing tables. And we had some very passionate testimony from community members. And then we also had some testimony from the department. And they had some concerns about this being in statute and not in rule because of federal regulations that were coming down the pipe and also their ability to make changes as those things potentially shifted and changed. And so my amendment strikes everything and changes it to say the commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry shall adopt rules using the expedient rulemaking process in Minnesota statute section 14.389 that set forth adult size changing facilities to conform with the addition of Minnesota statutes chapter 326B.106 subdivision 4 subsection under this act. So the purpose of this is to allow for both the department and also for community engagement and the ability to be flexible with additional potential changes. So with that is the amendment.
So with that, members, I'll move the A1 amendment. And as also was pointed out at the committee, normally we do code things in rules because then they can change them if they have to without having to go to the legislation. So any questions on the amendment, members? If not, all in favor of the A1 amendment, the House File 981, please say aye.
Aye.
Representative Hicks, if you want to just do a brief wrap up and we'll get you on your way.
Yes, thank you. None of my testifiers were able to be here today, and I know you have other important things on your agenda. So just as a reminder, people with disabilities want to participate in our community, and they want to be able to go to restaurants and to the aquarium and the museums, and they want to be able to come and testify before you. As it stands right now, if those individuals need to be changed while in the community, they are being laid on the floor. They're being put on the floor of bathrooms. Families are taking them out to minivans, folding down seats, trying to use blankets, trying to keep privacy, trying to create an opportunity for them to be able to engage in their community. But dignity is being lost in that current situation. This works to create an inclusive community for all and ensure that people with disabilities can participate fully in our community by being able to use the restroom in the same way the rest of us do.
And I see I missed this. We have one testifier on the bill, Roz Peterson, former representative. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, and then we'll get to a vote.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and members. My name is Roz Peterson, and I'm the public policy director for NAOP, which is a group of commercial, industrial, and multifamily developers who provide education, research, and best practices in commercial real estate. And our chapter is over 600 members strong in Minnesota, but it is a national organization as well. So as many of you know, the pandemic has shifted working patterns, among other things, as you know. Many of our office buildings downtown are facing foreclosure due to unforeseen vacancies. The development community is looking at adaptive reuse of these buildings, perhaps into multifamily or affordable housing options. As you've likely heard in the past, too, Minnesota costs more to build than our neighboring states, up to 30% more. Or even more than 30%. So higher interest rates have been blowing up deals for the past several months. coupled with the increase in materials, labor, and supply chain issues, as well as what the market can handle for affordability, it has become increasingly difficult to pencil the math to remodel antiquated structures, let alone build. That being said, the challenge with this amended bill is that it adds another mandate to all new or substantially remodeled buildings. By changing the state building code and giving rulemaking authority to DALI, the better process would be to use the one in place that involves all stakeholders who understand construction process, materials, best practices, new technologies, and are nimble enough to work with local governments to make sure people with disabilities have access under ADA and have the flexibility to understand each building's purpose and needs. After all, every building is different. The people who end up paying for these mandates ultimately are small business owners, your neighbors and friends in your community. As a policy, it is a bad practice to mandate building code with one person, the commissioner of DALI, who may or may not have expertise in architectural, structural engineering, plumbing, existing code across the trades, and costs of construction. On top of that, there is no process to involve stakeholders who have boots on the ground dealing with these issues every day. I'm afraid there will be unintended consequences from this approach. And for these reasons, we ask you, Chair Nelson and members, to oppose this approach to your lawmaking decisions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, this is the second time we've heard the bill. We had lots of testimony the first time, so other than Ms. Peterson who asked, you aren't going to have none of you to testify. And questions for the members, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Ms. Peterson. In your organization, is there a kind of a cost estimate for a commercial building, what this would be a cost for that particular project?
Well, we haven't done any.
Ms. Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. We haven't done any analysis specifically. However, as you can imagine, it takes up a lot of space. And if you're retrofitting a building, once you start dealing with bathrooms, you're dealing with plumbing. Plumbing is one of the most expensive parts of construction. And so if you basically will have to pull out fixtures to make enough room for the changing station, you're going to run into other compliance issues with capacity and other, you know, because you're losing bathrooms in order to accommodate this need.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Peterson.
Thank you.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Peterson, could you, what process would work best for, from your organization's perspective? What would you prefer to see?
Well, I would prefer.
Ms. Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. Apologies. I would prefer to see the process being involved with all stakeholders, like in the Uniform Building Code, working under existing ADA structures, so that it's consistent. And a lot of developers come in from outside the state, and it's difficult to understand when there's special different rules in our state regarding something that would take up that much room. And so those are the things that I would prefer. Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. And I would just like to add, the disability community has been trying to get this done for 20 years, and every time we try to get it done, we are told why it's inconvenient for other people, and that there are better ways to do it, different ways to do it. We'll do it a different way. We'll try it a different way. We can do it a different way. And it is still not done. I have been working in the field of disability since 1999. I have been changing adult men and adult women on dirty bathroom floors with paper towels for 20 years. And for 20 years, we have heard, as a disability community, we can get it done. Don't worry, there's a way to do it. We can do it, and it doesn't happen. And I believe that by going through rulemaking, we can get it done. By doing rapid rulemaking, we can hold dignity of people at a more of a priority than moving a toilet. We have fold-out technology has come a long way. There are wall-based tables that can fold down. There are a lot of ways to do this that hold people dignity and respect individual business need. And we are not asking for this in private homes. We are not asking for it in apartment buildings. We are asking for it in public buildings, so that people with cerebral palsy, so that people who have a spinal cord injury, can go to the museum with their kids. so that they can go to the hospital with and get be able to change without having to ask to use an exam room. We are asking for human dignity amongst what I understand is an inconvenience. But I believe that people with disabilities shouldn't be the inconvenience we sacrifice all the time. So I ask of you to think, if it was your child, if it was your wife, if it was your husband, if it was your sister or your brother, would moving a toilet at a museum be more important than their ability to be have their personal cares attended for with dignity?
Representative Mecklen.
No, I'm good. Thanks.
Any other questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Chair, I recognize that we've seen this bill before and we talked about it, but there are some questions that came up, especially with rulemaking authority. And Representative Hicks, certainly appreciate your passion, and certainly respect and dignity is very important when dealing with everyone in the disability community and in the business community, those who own the buildings, those who have to pay for it. So dignity and respect is very important, and especially it is certainly respectful to have a changing station and have allow this, but on every floor in every building. So I do have some questions regarding rulemaking authority, which I think is a wise thing to do, because they can really take the ample time necessary than and they have the time more so than we lawmakers who are here for 5 months. So I think that was a very wise move on your behalf. So I do have some questions for the Department of Labor regarding the rulemaking authority.
Department of Labor, I think. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Nelson, committee members. My name is Greg Metz. I'm a program manager for the Department of Labor and Industry, and I'm happy to take your questions.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Metz, as far as rulemaking authority and reasonableness, under her current bill, how does the process look when you come to rulemaking authority? What does it look like? What considerations? What kind of building structure? Is it in reconstruction older buildings that have only a smaller, perhaps a one bathroom? Just what are some of those things that look like in developing Representative Hicks' bill?
Mr. Metz.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the rulemaking process is initiated by the commissioner. It moves through the Construction Codes Advisory Committee. And typically, the Construction Codes Advisory Committee will designate a technical advisory group, which is a group of stakeholders that hold public meetings that are available for anyone to attend and provide public comment. We follow the Administrative Procedures Act, so we have a very thorough rules process and a very transparent process that we're required to follow in the development of rules. The state building code is required to adopt model codes and then modify them as necessary to make them Minnesota specific. But we largely try to stay as close as we can to what the model code requirements are. We adopt the International Building Code as our model code standard for the state of Minnesota. The next model code will be the 2024 International Building Code. That 2024 International Building Code does include requirements for adult size changing tables within the model code document. What we would be doing with this accelerated rulemaking process is basically accelerating the adoption of those very specific criteria for adult size changing tables into our rules now, rather than waiting until 2026, which would be our regular next adoption cycle enforcement date.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Metz, for that explanation. Are you familiar with the Maryland's baby changing bill that they passed? Representative Hicks may probably is as well, because Minnesota is not unique in this, but will be a leader in it. Are you familiar with their particular bill?
I'm not.
Bill? So,
Representative McDonald.
Sorry.
We have that.
Mr. Metz, I was passed.
No, that's sorry, Mr. Chair. We always want to go through the chair.
Yeah.
Well, so Maryland also passed this, Representative Hicks, you're probably familiar with, but they did it in such a way where it was a little bit more reasonable for buildings, more, I think it was $30,000 or more renovation. seems to be a little more reason. It wasn't on every single floor. It at least allowed it, and some of it was state and federal buildings only that allowed this as well. So they just, in doing so, they just had a little bit more reasonableness in allowing this, so for purposes of changing.
So Mr. Metz, my understanding of the code is that it's substantial remodeling or new buildings that the code applies to, not every little remodeling that we do on a building. If you want to answer, and then I see Representative Hicks has got
yes.
to speak also.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that is correct. It's actually not even all new construction. The model code specifically addresses assembly buildings and mercantile buildings and educational buildings primarily. And those buildings, when they require six or more water closets within the facility. So as an example, a mercantile facility like a Target or a Walmart or someplace like that would have to be 150,000 square feet or larger before an adult size changing table would be required in that facility.
Representative Hicks.
Yes, and I just want to clarify, Mr. Representative, I maybe wasn't clear. I struck the entire bill language and replaced it with just rule. So all of the language that was in that original bill has been struck, and now it will just happen through the rulemaking, and we're going to, the department is going to use those universal codes. So I'm not really sure what you're talking about when you talk about every floor and all of that. All of that's been struck with this amendment. So I think there may be a little bit of a misunderstanding. So I just wanted to clarify that piece so that we weren't talking about two different things.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hicks, no, I completely and 100% knew exactly what you were talking about. That's why I asked the Department of Labor to come down and explain their labor, explain the rulemaking authority. Now, that's why I complimented you earlier, saying I thought it was very wise to take this from the legislature, who we don't know at all here in the 5 months we're here, and put it on the impetus on the Department of Labor. So that's why I asked him to come down. So.
Okay, thank you. I was just, yeah. I thought maybe we had a miscommunication. Oh, sorry, Chair.
Representative Hicks, yes.
I just wanted to clarify. I thought maybe we had I maybe wasn't clear. I apologize. This is the first time I've done a delete all an amendment, so I was afraid I maybe made a mistake.
Yeah.
Any further questions? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 981, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. The bill's on its way to the General Register. Thank you. Next bill on our agenda, yes. House File 1571. Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Economic Development. Representative Byrd, do you want to make your motion?
Yes, I make my motion to send House File 1571 to Economic Development.
We got the motion, the bill in front of us. Do you want to explain your bill? I see there's a DE amendment on this also. Do you want that done first?
Is that
yes. Your amendment?
Yes, it is my amendment.
Representative Byrd moves the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the shape that she wishes. Representative Schultz.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Byrd, could you walk us through the changes to it that we're about to adopt?
Yes.
Representative Byrd.
One moment. I just have my notes. I need to get the paper from my pile.
When you're ready, Representative Byrd, go ahead.
Okay, so the DE moves to amend House File 1571 as follows. Delete everything after the enacting clause and insert Section 1, Minnesota Statutes 2022, Section 116J.871, Subdivision 2, is amended to read. Subdivision 2, prevailing wage required. A state agency may provide financial assistance to a person only if the person receiving or benefiting from the financial assistance certifies to the Commissioner of Labor and Industry that laborers and mechanics at the project site during construction, installation, remodeling, and repairs for which the financial assistance was provided will be paid the prevailing wage rate as defined in Section 177.42, Subdivision 6, and be subject to the requirements and enforcement provisions of Section 17.27, 177.30, 177.32, 177.41 to 177.435, and 177.45. B, for the purposes of a person subject to paragraph A, who is required to comply with Section 177.30, paragraph A, clauses 6 and 7, the state agency awarding the financial assistance is considered the contracting authority and the project is considered a public works project. The person receiving or benefiting from the financial assistance shall notify all employers on the project of the record keeping and reporting requirements of Section 177.30, paragraph A, clauses 6 and 7. Each employer shall submit the required information to the contracting authority.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Berg for providing an explanation to this. I see that the primary change is in lines point 1.9 and 1.10 in the DE amendment, and it's citing several different sections. Any further clarification as to those sections of law that you have now added into this bill?
I will go through the my presentation of the bill, and that may become more clear. And then I also have some witnesses and testifiers here that, should I miss anything, which is always possible, will help answer that question.
And so why don't we put the amendment on, because that will be the bill then. All in favor of doing the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the shape that the author wants, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Explain your bill, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So under current law, Minnesota Statute 116J.871 requires the payment of prevailing wage rates to construction workers on projects funded by deed economic development grants. Like on other prevailing wage sites, there are record-keeping requirements for contractors who work on the site, and all employers are required to collect and keep certified payroll records for compliance purposes. But unlike on other prevailing wage projects, these certified payroll records are kept by a state agency since DEED gives out grants and doesn't technically hold the construction contracts. This bill simply makes DEED the contracting authority for purposes of collecting the certified payroll records. If this bill passes, all projects in Minnesota where state law requires the payment of prevailing wage rates will have the same record-keeping requirements and be subject to the same public oversight. This bill does not expand the requirement to pay the prevailing wage or increase the prevailing wage. It simply creates uniformity in the ability to ensure that construction workers working on state-funded projects are being paid what they are already legally entitled to. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Watkins. I'm the Education and Policy Coordinator for the Fair Contracting Foundation. We are a nonprofit labor management committee, jointly trusteed by the building trades as well as their signatory contractors. And we were created 12 years ago to serve as a public compliance watchdog for the construction industry. And just to really kind of emphasize what the representative was just saying is that this is in no way an expansion of prevailing wage. This is about ensuring consistency in oversight and transparency in those projects that already require prevailing wage. Because of the way, because typically when prevailing wage is required, it's because the state agency is directly contracting for that sort of work. But because these economic development grants are often awarded to private entities, there's there's a disconnect between making sure that those certified payroll records become publicly accessible because they are not ultimately housed within DEED itself, as opposed to other agencies such as DOT, any of the MNSCU system, DNR, admin, all of those other agencies. So this is merely about ensuring that whenever these projects are funded, and in order to ensure that prevailing wages are paid and so that the public can exercise oversight of those programs, this is just ensuring that those records ultimately get submitted to DEED, where then they can be obtained to the general public via the normal Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. I apologize for my voice. I'm getting over being sick.
That's okay. Questions of the testifier? Questions on the bill? Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions. So under this bill, now as amended, all the paperwork from whoever is doing the work now needs to be submitted with DEED. Is that correct? And then they sit on that paperwork?
Mr. Watkins or Representative Berg?
Yep.
Mr. Watkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that is correct. DEED would be the final repository for that information, again, in the same way that agencies such as admin and DOT are as well.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I believe that Representative Berg described that the DEED would now have the contracting authority. And under that contracting authority, how does that mesh with House File 1859? Because it would appear that their DEED is now the top contractor, which means they're over the general contractor, who is actually doing the work in this scenario.
Representative Mr. Watkins, I see you have a puzzled look on your face, that we're sending this to Economic Development, Finance, and Policy, where DEED would be the primary for there. We don't think we have anybody here from DEED right now.
Mr. Chair, is there anybody from the Department of Labor still here? Apparently not.
Mr. Watkins, I see you.
Mr. Chair and representatives, what I can speak is currently the way the process works is whenever an economic development grant is made via DEED, there is included in that language a certification page in which that MnDOLI, the recipients sign off saying that they will ensure that anybody who is working on those projects, any contractors, will be paid prevailing wage and will create certified payroll reports. So this is not a new requirement. They're already going to have to do that based on the certification page that gets attached to the grant agreement. Unfortunately, that certification page only grants MnDOLI access to those records. It essentially says upon request those records must be made available to MnDOLI. This is just making it so that there's not that kind of attenuated process, and that when contractors are working on projects funded underneath that agency, that they will just simply be submitting those records back to DEED ultimately, rather than them kind of going into the ether.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to, I still do think that there's, based on what we heard that last week or whatever it was for 1859, the all liability falls on the one on top. But beyond that, to Representative Berg, is DEED going to need any more employees to take on all this additional paperwork? And is there like a cost that they're going to bear, or a fiscal note for this?
There was a fiscal note included in your packet for this, and it's come back as zero. So, Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Mecklen. It is not my understanding that they're going to need to hire anybody else. This is something that's already in place for other entities, such as the other departments that my testifier mentioned. However, we can certainly revisit that should we find out that to be the case.
Representative Mecklen.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Berg. My concern is we've heard repeatedly that whether it was OSHA or Department of Labor, they don't have the staff, they need more people. You're going to add an enormous amount of new paperwork that they have to store and accept and keep track of, but they don't have the people to do what they need to do now. It's very unfortunate there's nobody here from DEED or DOLI that can help answer some of these questions, but I'll leave it there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Berg. First, for the record and for the committee's purpose, I just did look up House File 1859, and the way that the language is currently written in this, it would directly apply to deed. And so I think that that's something that, that maybe you can work out with Representative Feist and ensure that we're not putting our state in a place where we don't want to be. So that first, for the record. And then to the author, this particular bill specifically mentions projects, public works projects, and I just wanted to ask, you know, how, are there any deed grants that you're aware of currently, and recognizing we don't have deed with us today, that would be projects that impact housing in our state, and how that would play itself out in our state?
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz. Not at this moment, but again, certainly happy to have conversations with Deed and get back to you offline unless my testifier has information that I don't. Great.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Berg. I will be supporting this bill today, and I think that it's a strong step to support our Minnesota workers and ensure that that prevailing wage that is already in law is something where our employers, and especially those receiving state assistance, will be getting the prevailing wage. So that is a good bill. So thank you.
Any further questions? If not, Representative Berg renews her motion that House File 1571, as amended, be re-referred. Make sure you get the right place. The Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill's on its way.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Watkins. And Representative Berg, you have the next amendment also, or next bill also, House File 2442, and that needs to go to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. If you want to make your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I move that House File 2442 be sent to Judiciary and Finance and Law. I'm sorry.
Finance and Civil Law.
How about that?
Bills in front of us, and I don't see an amendment. No amendments, so if you want to explain your bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. So this is a really important bill, and I am certainly honored to have been asked to carry it. This creates, House File 2442 creates a new minimum labor standard in Chapter 181 that protects employees' freedom of conscience by prohibiting employers from forcing employees to attend political or religious meetings or to listen to religious or political speech. This includes captive audience meetings for the purpose of communicating the employer's opinion about whether or not the employee should support or join a union. So I can just walk through the bill quickly. Subdivision 1 prohibits employers from disciplining, firing, or otherwise retaliating against an employee for refusing to attend employer-sponsored meetings, listen to speech, or view communications primarily intended to convey the employer's opinion about political or religious matters. Subdivision 2 allows employees to bring a civil action in district court against an employer who violates this section within 90 days of the alleged violation. The court may award the employee injunctive relief, reinstatement, back pay, reestablishment of benefits, and any other relief deemed necessary to make the employee whole, including reasonable attorney fees. Subdivision 3 requires employers to post a notice of employee rights under this section within 30 days of enactment. Subdivision 4 makes clear that this section does not prohibit employers from discussing workplace issues, does not prohibit employers from asking or inviting employees to religious or political meetings or to communicate about religious or political matters as long as employee participation is wholly voluntary, and does not prohibit an employer from communicating information to employees that is necessary for employees to perform their job. Subdivision 5 provides definition of political matters and religious matters. With that, I will turn it over to our testifiers. We have seven testifiers, including President Burnham from the AFL-CIO, and I will be available to answer questions from committee members as needed, as well as some of my other testifiers.
And the first person on my list here is Bernie Burnham. Welcome to the committee, and give your name, and then you can proceed with your testimony.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Nelson and members. My name is Bernie Burnham, and I am the president of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, the labor movement's shared voice of more than 300,000 working people who belong to more than 1,000 local unions in every corner of our state. In America, we value our many freedoms and constitutional rights. We value the freedom to hold our own religious and political views so much it's the First Amendment in our Constitution. Even when we're on the job, we expect a degree of those freedoms to extend to the workplace. That's why the Minnesota AFL-CIO is proud to support House File 2442 to protect those freedoms at work. With the recent surge of union organizing drives in Minnesota and across the nation, we've also seen the rise in employers holding mandatory meetings for the sole purpose of dissuading workers from exercising their legal right to form a union. These meetings have nothing to do with the actual jobs that workers do for an employer. In fact, many workers describe them as raw intimidation. These meetings often create a chilling effect that in many cases dooms the organizing effort, even when a significant majority of workers have signed union authorization cards to trigger an election. When Minnesotans go to work, we expect to do the jobs we were hired to do, and for any mandatory meetings to focus on that work. We don't expect to be forced to attend meetings against our will that promote a particular religious or political agenda or listen to veiled threats about exercising our legal right to organize. Freedom of conscience is a principle that Americans across the political spectrum value, and that freedom should extend, that freedom should extend to the workplace. Working Minnesotans urge you to protect that freedom by passing House File 2442. Thank you.
Thank you for your, and if you want to hang around, we have questions for you as we go on.
Thank you.
Next person I have on my list is Kip Hedges. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Kip Hedges is my name. I was a baggage handler for Delta Airlines for 28 years until they fired me for union organizing. It was so blatant and over the line that Delta was ultimately forced to unfire me. However, after being treated so poorly by a company that I had built for nearly three decades, I decided not to return and to move on with my life. I would say that every single day that a workers decided to be publicly in favor of unionization wonders whether they will return home to their wife and family, or their husband and family, or their partner, and tell them that they no longer have a job because of their views on union organizing. The company has a number of companies have a number of tools that they use to intimidate and harass pro-union employees. They have anti-union law firms that help craft anti-union campaigns and sharpen and hone their ability to intimidate, harass, and destroy union organizing drives. Sometimes they make sure the company stays on this side of the law. Sometimes they make sure the company stays just on this side of the law. Or in my case, they went way over here. They have flyers, they have social media, they have, in my case at Delta, they have TVs in the break rooms where there's a continuous loop of anti-union messages. There's a regular bombardment of anti-union opinions being barraged at the workforce. I think this bill really asks you to take away one of those tools. That's fundamentally what it does. Doesn't the rest of it has to do with federal law, et cetera. But this takes away one of the tools, and it helps workers like me to have a voice, to have some dignity, and to not be driven underground by a company's animus towards union organizing and workers. Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. The next person I have on my list is Patrick Kennedy. And then after that, I have Nate Krantz. But so you can be ready. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Patrick Kennedy. I'm a licensed independent clinical social worker. I'm testifying today in support of House File 2442. Starting in 2016, I worked for 6 years at a nonprofit community mental health center. I held 4 different positions and served hundreds of clients. I felt proud to work in community mental health and grateful to meet professionals like me who cared about 2 things: helping vulnerable people feel better and improving the field of mental health for the next generation of helpers. But I wondered if this work was their passion, why was the turnover so high, why was it getting worse? One colleague with a master's degree worked a second job to pay her bills, and another hadn't had a raise in 8 years. Managers told staff that the trick to longevity at the agency was to marry rich. When the pandemic started, we knew that management wouldn't prioritize our well-being. In helping professions, we often say you can't pour from an empty cup. I talked with colleagues about forming a union to make change within the system. With a union, we could use our firsthand experience and collaboration with management to improve conditions for staff and, in turn, improve the care we offer to clients. 16 months later, we were on track to form the first labor union in Minnesota at a community mental health center. By late October, nearly 60% of the 130 eligible workers had publicly committed their support for a union. Before the election period, we were made to attend a series of mandatory information sessions presented by the CEO and HR director. In one meeting, we were told that wage increases were just about to roll out, but could be delayed another year if we unionized. In another, the CEO assured us that a union would only harm our clients. The effect on the vote count was shocking. 59 votes against forming a union, 55 in favor. In just a few weeks, union support had dropped from 60% to 42%. Months later, a colleague confronted the CEO at a town hall meeting, saying, "I made a mistake by voting against the union. I still haven't seen any of the changes you promised." As a social worker, I have a responsibility to challenge oppressive power structures. Employers use mandatory meetings to unfairly influence workers. If the meetings didn't influence workers, they wouldn't be happening. The person who signs your paychecks should not be allowed to force you, under threat of discipline or retaliation, to listen to their opinions about your legally protected right to choose whether to join a union. Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Mr. Krantz. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Nate Krantz. I'm here with SEIU Healthcare Minnesota in Iowa. I come from a union family. My father was a lifelong IBEW member, and many of my relatives are lifelong and strong union supporters as well as members. It should go without saying that I will support my coworkers whenever they form a union. And yeah, so I worked as a CNA, a certified nurse aide, for about a year and a half. And at the last place that I worked, my workers chose to form a union. This was something that management clearly was opposed to. So they called us into regular meetings to remind us of that fact. Management's opposition to their workers forming a union can be broken down into 3 basic categories: a refusal to bargain, a complaint about democracy, or just a flat-out lie. During the run-up to our election, we were privileged to be exposed to any number of those 3 on a weekly basis, and the week before the election, every day. Management would couch their language in the fact that workers had a choice, but insisted that choice was the wrong one. I know why I support a union. I know what management was insisting was false, if not disingenuous. Regardless, I noticed that my heart rate tracker on my Apple Watch showed a spike in my heart rate each time I had to sit through one of those meetings. It's clearly intimidating. I remember other workers who were union supporters who would not wear a pin and would tell me they were being secret about their support because they didn't want to attract unwanted attention from management. The fact of the matter is that it is a radical thing to disagree with your supervisor. They're the ones who decide whether or not you get a paycheck next week. And of course, you'll be afraid to take a position contrary to theirs. The workers know this, so does management. Union elections are meant to be a decision made by the workers free of interference from management. But the constant drumbeat of anti-union speech directed through official company meetings, while not being explicitly a directive, carries the same weight as a directive. Management knows this, and that's why they do it. Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Next person I have on my list is John Arbogast. And after that, I have a Jeff Schreiner. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Arbogast. I am a United Steelworkers staff representative from District 11 from Northern Minnesota. My primary function is the five taconite mines in Northern Minnesota. Before I read Mr. Smith's testimony, who couldn't be with us today, I'd like to acknowledge that in the back left and the full center, we have miners from Northern Minnesota that drove down to attend your committee hearing and keep an eye on Representative Schultz.
Good idea.
Mr. Smith couldn't make it, Mr. Chairman. Someone had to stay back and run the mines. Here is his testimony. My name is Dave Smith. I'm a member of the United Steelworkers Local 2660 at Keetac Iron Ore Operations. Years ago, when I was fresh out of the Army, I took a job as a mechanic with a local contractor who did maintenance work on the power lines. The company had just been purchased by the local electric cooperative, whose workers were represented by a union. Many of my coworkers thought that we would be joining the union after the purchase, and I had hopes that this would bring union wages and benefits to my young family. It wasn't long before one of my coworkers came around with union cards for us to sign, but the company found out about it, and quickly we realized that we weren't going to be quietly let into the union. They quickly fired the worker with the union cards for an unrelated infraction, and management told us why they thought we didn't need a union. After that talk of joining the union went silent, I think everyone was just afraid they would lose their jobs. A couple years went by, and working conditions went downhill. People were forced to drive trucks and equipment across the state to the Dakotas and Wisconsin without pay. Safety was lax. Workers were getting hurt on a regular basis. Management was always pushing for faster production. A few of us had enough. We contacted the Minnesota AFL-CIO for help. They put us in touch with an organizing team from the Labor's International Union. Over the next few months, the labor organizers went door-to-door, getting more than 90% of us to sign union cards and helped us choose our co-workers who would lead the effort to organize. We decided to ask the company to voluntarily recognize the laborers as our union. We did this by appealing directly to the company's owner, the electric cooperative. At their monthly board meeting, several members of the board were visibly unhappy that we came to their meeting to surprise them with our request. They quickly denied our request and ushered us out. We soon learned that the company had hired a union buster, and we were all required to come into the company headquarters from our job sites across the upper Midwest to attend a mandatory meeting. At the meeting, several of the electrical cooperative's board members were present, and they told us about why we didn't need a union coming between us. They forced us to watch videos about how labor unions were corrupt and tied to organized crime. The videos told us about how the union was going to charge us big initiation fees and monthly dues. They told us about how union bosses would steal our money and how union make companies go bankrupt. We were forced to listen to the retired lawyers and accountants from the cooperative's board tell us all the reasons we shouldn't vote for the union. The meetings continued regularly while the union filed to have an election with the National Labor Relations Board. The National Labor Relations Board held an election. We won by a landslide. We're finally going to get our union. We sat down with the company to negotiate our first contract, but things didn't go smoothly. The company stalled and made things difficult for the next year. They targeted workers who were leaders in supporting the union with discipline for made-up infractions. The union filed unfair labor practice charges against the company for this, and we continued to negotiate until 1 year passed after the election. The company then got a worker to file a petition with the NLRB to decertify our union. Then the mandatory meeting started up again. This time they worked and the company won. After more than 3 years of trying to gain a voice at work and not moving forward, workers believed all the lies that they were forced to listen to over the years. As I look back at my experience trying to stand together with my coworkers to gain a voice at work, I know that other workers are facing the same challenges that we faced. I know workers are forced to attend captive audience meetings, while workers are left to try and organize in secrecy for fear of losing their jobs. I urge you to pass this bill and level the playing field for workers in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. You did a good job reading that. Jeff Schreiner. And the next person I have is Dave Snyder. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Jeff Schreiner. I work for Cisco Food Service out of St. Cloud, Minnesota. Thank you for having me here today. Thank you, Representative Berg. I strongly believe that captive audience anti-union meetings by companies are harmful and must be stopped. These meetings are designed to discourage employees from joining and supporting a union by representing a one-sided biased view of the union and its activities. They are often mandatory, requiring employees to attend and listen to the company's anti-union message regardless of their personal belief. These meetings are a clear violation of workers' rights and freedom to organize. The right to form and join a union is fundamental right to all workers, and companies that try to interfere with this right are acting unethically and immorally. These meetings are also unfair to workers who are often put in a position where they have to choose between their job and their right to join a union. Many workers are afraid to speak out against the company's anti-union message for fear of retaliation and losing their job. This creates a climate of fear and intimidation that by design has an effect on a worker's ability to exercise their rights. These meetings are often used by companies to spread misinformation and propaganda about unions. They may falsely claim that unions are ineffective, corrupt, or only interested in collecting dues from members. This misinformation is used to deceive workers who may have access to accurate information about the benefits of joining a union, including better wages, benefits, and working conditions. I call on companies to respect workers' rights to form and join a union and to stop using captive audience meetings as a tool of intimidation and misinformation. From a worker's point of view, being made to attend captive audience anti-union meetings can be deeply unsettling and intimidating experience. These meetings are typically held by management or other representatives of the company with the goal of dissuading workers from forming a union. In a free democratic society, workers have the right to organize and collectively bargain for better wages, working conditions, and benefits. These meetings attempt to dissuade workers from exercising this fundamental right, which can leave workers feeling powerless and disempowered. Additionally, these meetings can be psychologically stressful for workers who may feel that their livelihoods are at risk if they do not comply with the management's wishes. Workers may feel pressured to conform to the company's anti-union stance, even if they do not agree with it or feel that it is in their best interest. In my experience, these meetings can and have created a toxic work environment by pitting workers against each other. Management may use fear tactics or misinformation to try to convince workers that unions are harmful, and in doing so may create an atmosphere of distrust and suspicion among colleagues. Overall, attending captive audience meetings can be a deeply negative experience for workers. It can leave them feeling disempowered, stressed, and fearful, and can create a toxic work environment that undermines teamwork and collaboration. And coming from 20 years working for a company, we recently did finally unionize. It was about a 10-year effort to do so, and along with the witnesses before me, it's almost like there's a script that companies follow, and it is very hard to form a union. And like the one gentleman said, this is just one tool, you know, only one tool that helps balance the scales of power, I guess, or fairness. And it was quite an experience, and it is stressful firsthand, because I was very deep in the process, And ultimately, we did prevail in St. Cloud, but it wasn't for a lack of trying for 10 years. So I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. Dave Schneider.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Berg. Thank you very much for letting me come and speak briefly for you today.
What's your name?
Oh, sorry. My name's Dave Schneider. I'm the Deputy Director of Jewish Community Action in St. Paul, and I live with my family in Richfield. After I was invited to speak about this bill, I walked back into my living room and saw that my wife was engaged in a time-honored parental ritual of helping our son Spencer, who's 15, apply for his first job. He's hoping for a lot of manual labor and not a lot of customer service. But as I thought about it, I realized that this bill is important to me both professionally but also personally. Spencer is proud of his religious identity as a Jew. My mother, his grandmother, or Bubby, helped to found our synagogue in South Minneapolis almost 30 years ago. And I now serve on the board, bless you, and as a religious school teacher. Spencer is actually in my class this year. He's pretty good. I'm getting used to having more and more things about his life being out of my control as he's a teenager, but I don't think it's too much to ask that my son and every other worker in our state be free from punishment or coercion if they don't want to pray at work, no matter what faith tradition they're coming from. My organization, Jewish Community Action, also deeply supports religious pluralism and freedom. I've been an organizer for 25 years, spent a great deal of that time at JCA, and it's a matter of organizational and personal pride that we provide a space for folks in Minnesota who are compelled by Jewish values, practices, and history to take action for social, economic, and racial justice. That means a lot to our members. And some of our most meaningful moments, some of my most meaningful moments of public work, involve learning together with our Christian and Muslim and secular partners how to respect each other's traditions and beliefs, how to create spaces for collective public action that let us all show up as our full selves while honoring the plurality of traditions and sometimes the abstention from faith traditions that each compel us into action and sustain us through tough times. I think that's the spirit and intention of House File 2442, and I'm proud to support it and ask you for your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider. And Representative Berg, you have any short thing you want to say before we go to questions?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think first and foremost, now that we've gotten the formalities out of the way, I just want to welcome this whole room full of labor. It's a reminder of why we do this work. As a former steel worker, I've got my steel workers over there in the corner. Love that. Love that IBEW is here. Carpenters were here last week. I am really excited that all members of our committee are going to support this bill. Representative Schultz stood up and thanked the IBEW for being here. So did Lead McDonald. That was amazing. You stood up on the floor and talked about how important our workers are. I love that. This is a very labor-friendly committee, and I am excited to see this bill pass unanimously today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And first person on my list is Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Berg, and to the members of the audience here. I do share some questions and some concern as we look at this bill, both through the lens of the scope and the other bills that are moving this session, as I don't know that they entirely match up. Just last week in this committee, we heard House File 1690, which provides that there is a mandatory sharing of data from a new employee to a union, and that bill seems to kind of run counter to this bill in the mandates, because in this frame the employer doesn't have the ability to speak to the employees in the same way that the union is mandatorily in 1690 being given access to their data. That is a concern for me. But let's also look at this through the lens of some of my friends who work in the iron mines in northern Minnesota. We know, especially because of the Iron Ore Alliance between U.S. Steel and between USW, that there are common interests between employer and employee and union. And I worry about the context of this bill limiting the ability for us to be able to do this. So, Representative Berg, can you explain to us how you see 1690 as it compares to this bill and how those two things don't quite match up?
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your question and your sentiments. So I kind of want to go backwards. First of all, totally agree that there are many instances where the employer and the union work together. I've been a union member, organizer, and labor leader for 20 years. I'm fierce, but I'm fair. And if you were to ask my airline, they would tell you I'm fair. And so I hear you and agreed. In terms of whether or not the two bills match up, number one is data, right? And we talked about how we're required to give our employer all of our data and keep it updated. And that's just bottom line for employment. The union also wants the data of its employees so that it can disseminate information to the members that's really important to them. And so that's data. What this bill does, it says it cannot hold an employee in a space while the employer explains, is a nice way to put it, all of their views, whether on the union, whether or not there should be a right to organize, what the union is going to take away from you and how big, bad the unions are, or religious views or political views. And all it's saying is if the employee wants to have that discussion with their employer, that's great. This just says it cannot be required and you cannot be punished if you say that's just not for me. No, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Berg. It's an important distinction to make because this bill has a kind of a wide scope of conversation over the definitions regards to political matters and religious matters. And I think it's a little bit too broad. And I think that it should be cleaned up in the work as it moves forward.
Further questions? Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Berg. Can you just explain to me, under this bill, can employers still have these conversations, these kinds of meetings and conversations?
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Greenman. I'm sorry, are you asking do they still have them or should they or can they?
Thank you. Let me, I have a little bit of a cold, let me rephrase that. Can employers still have conversations with employees who want to be there to disseminate the information that they're currently disseminating?
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenman. Of course, but the employee has to agree to it. If there is zero consent from the employee to have a conversation like that, then it simply cannot be done. And you also can't get disciplined or fired or treated unfairly or somehow retaliated against for simply choosing not to engage.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Berg, for this bill. I will be honest and admit, embarrassingly, when I had this conversation yesterday with someone from the AFL-CIO, that I just assumed that you could walk away from these meetings as an employee. Yeah. I just assumed you couldn't be retaliated against if your employer wants to have a closed-door meeting with you about politics or religion or anti-union, that getting up and walking out of the meeting had to be protected, and so that is on me. But I'm really grateful for all of you who came here to, one, tell your stories and illuminate this. I think that this is so common sense that I would guess that a lot of people are like me and already assume that there's some protections in law. But since there aren't, thank you for bringing this. Thank you all for being here, and we absolutely should pass this year. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Berg, certainly on the first reading of it seems to make sense. Yeah, you know, no employer should force any worker, employee, to listen to a political speech or go to a religious revival or whatever. And I would think that's not happened already, but if it is, I guess we have to put in law, you know, what human nature is what it is. If you don't put it in law, I guess we don't know. We shouldn't be doing it. It's unfortunate to human nature. But your bill is very broad, and nowhere in here does it mention anything about collective bargaining or unions. It's all about legislating, politics, religion. So I'm surprised why you wouldn't put in here. We heard testimony after testimony about union bashing. And no, I don't think any employer should be telling and mandating that their employees come in while they bash a union who maybe want a collective bargaining. That's the freedom of speech. But nowhere in your bill does it even mention that. So that's probably still could happen unless you point it out. Because in your section under 2.23 or actually 2.19, political matters, means matters relating to election for political office, political parties, proposals to change legislation. So, for example, if the unions wanted to come here to protest against legislation or in favor of something, I agree they shouldn't be forced to, but if they're required to by their employer and said, hey, we're going to pay you to come, is that such a bad thing if they want to come here to testify or listen to the legislation that's proposed? Proposals to change regulations, proposals to change public policy, or decision to join or support any political or party or political civic community. Here's what I have a concern with. A civic community, fraternal organizations. So civic communities such as the Lions Club, the Women's Club, Toastmasters. So let's just say under your bill that the employer says, all the employees, I want you to come to the Toastmaster meeting because it's going to make you a better public speaker. It's mandatory. It'll help you in your sales. It'll help you dealing with the public. It'll help you as you work with the passengers on an airline, et cetera, et cetera. But under your bill, that couldn't happen. And that part, I think, many would have a concern with, and I hope that you maybe would as too, because the bill is so broad. A church or a synagogue, or a mosque, they employ people, right? And if they say it's mandatory to come to the church for a meeting, we're going to talk about religious issues because they're a church, they're a mosque, they're a synagogue. Under your bill, an employee could say, no, I'm suing. I'm going to take civil action because Representative Berg's bill passed. Those are concerns that many of us have, and I hope that everybody in the audience has that very same concern because of the broad spectrum of the bill. For those who don't know, in law, if we don't put it in law or the intent of the law, that leaves it too transparent and opaque. Actually, they're both the same thing, transparent and opaque. Yeah. It leaves it too wide open for litigation and for someone to break the law. So I'm just curious on what you have to say about that.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Lead McDonald. That was a lot. And I appreciate your thoughtfulness. I really do. I appreciate that you're taking this seriously and that you're kind of bringing some new things to mind. It is my understanding that when you include political in the bill, that sort of falls under that. But I do have someone here who could probably answer that question because they don't want to just give you, you know, my opinion. I'd like you to have some facts. So if I may turn it over, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Melissa Heising, and I'm Legislative Director at Minnesota AFL-CIO. Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I would point you to lines 2.15 to 2.17. Under scope, this section does not limit the rights of an employer from communicating to its employees any information that is necessary for the employees to perform their lawfully required job duties.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you state that again? I didn't have my cheaters on.
Sure. So lines 2.15 to 2.17 under scope. So under scope, it says this section does not. And then starting on line 2.15, so this section does not limit the rights of an employer or its agent, representative, or designee from communicating to its employees any information that is necessary for the employees to perform their lawfully required job duties.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, thank you. And I did read that part. I didn't highlight it. But the broad, the definitions of the bill, though, supersede that and allow for a very broad spectrum of her bill, such as the examples I gave in her definitions. They would supersede sections 2.15. And for example, Mr. Chair, if I may, and I'll give you one more example, then I guess I'll be done with it. So as lawmakers, we're asked to speak in schools, right? For government policies, civics. I've been speaking at our schools for years as the mayor and then as a politician, blah, blah, blah. But by law, I guess the teacher are supposed to go to the, you know, to the speech, right? So your bill would forbid that as well. And I think that's just a dangerous area that because of this broadness of the bill, that would prohibit that as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I would disagree with your interpretation of the bill. The bill does not restrict employer speech. It simply gives employees the right not to listen to the speech. Employers can continue to speak on any subject as long as they do not force employees to listen. The bill regulates captive audiences, not speech. So, for example, the employer would not be prohibited from discussing workplace issues, including health and safety matters. They could invite elected officials to discuss current events. They could encourage employees to volunteer on campaigns. They could ask employees to voluntarily contact elected officials. They could invite employees to voluntarily attend church services. They could encourage participation in employer-sponsored volunteer, charitable, or community events and activities, so long as the participation was voluntary.
Representative Hussein, you had a question.
Thank you for bringing this bill forward. And I just have one question. Does the union has a closed door meeting? And if so, would the employee get punished if they leave from their workplace?
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that question. No, because unions are not the organization that has the power to punish an employee. That exists in the power structure of the employer.
Representative Hussein.
I thank you very much, and I wanted to thank all the testifiers who showed up and shared their story with us today, and I want to thank Kip Hedges, who came forward and share with his stories. This is not the first time we get in this kind of stories, and it's really hurt me. And I want to make sure that as a legislator, we want to take care of workers. We want to take care of unions. And I came from a union background. My whole family are working for unions. And it is very difficult for me to face intimidations, harassment for those employees. It is very sad to hear that in these committees, different workers, different locations throughout our state, and as a legislator, we want to make sure that we hold accountability for those companies, the large corporate, who's taken advantage for those our workers. And I want to thank you, Representative Burke, for bringing this bill forward. And I hope for all my colleague and I could vote for this great bill. And Representative Schultz, my friend, I hope we can all vote this one together. Thank you.
Representative Jordan. Any further questions? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have decided to support this bill today. I do think that it could be more clearly defined, and I encourage the author to work with stakeholders, especially to the points that have already been raised on the scope of the bill. So I just hope that we can work together on this so that all speech remains free here in America.
Representative McDonald, earlier you looked like you were going to pull your microphone. Do you want a final?
No, I don't, Representative. I'm Chair Nelson. Isaac Schultz said it best.
Representative Burke, if you want to wrap up, and then we'll renew your motion.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Super quick, I just want to answer Lead McDonald's question the best that I can, because you know. So in subsection 5 under definitions, it does include labor organizations in the definition, so I don't know if that makes you feel a little bit better about how broad this bill is.
I see him shaking his head, yes.
Wonderful. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to bring this forward. Thank you to this room full of amazing workers who came out to support this bill because it changes their life. Representative Schultz, you mentioned you wanted all speech to be free speech. Absolutely. And this bill does guarantee that because it makes it the employee's choice to have any kind of conversation or any kind of meeting with the employer where any of the things that we have put in this bill has to be with their consent. And yes, we're lawmakers. We're not perfect. So I am happy to continue to have conversations because I want to make sure, and I know all of you want to make sure as well, that we protect our workers to the very best of our ability because they give us their very best every day. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, Representative Byrd renews her motion that House File 2442 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill's on its way. Members, that's it for today. We have a meeting Thursday at the same time. And members, I know it's after lunch and people, but if people can meet here at 1 o'clock, we can get going and get started. Thank you, members. We're adjourned.